Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and everyone knows that I'm a huge fan of the TV show Angel, several other vampire series and shows and movies out there that I enjoy, and Near Dark is one of them. I saw it actually in, I think there was like a second run or some sort of weird, you know, underground cult movies showing that they were showing it instead of Rocky Horror Picture Show one midnight night. And I loved this film, and I couldn't find this film on home video until never, actually. But I did find the soundtrack, which I was delighted to buy. And Near Dark, to my amazement, is the subject of an academic book. So you know that got my attention. And its author, Stacy Abbott, is here to talk with us today about that. She is a reader in film and television studies at the University of Roehampton in the UK. And she's also written a book about Angel. So we're going to have fun with this. Hi, Stacy. Welcome.
Hi, Summer. Thanks for having me.
The just finding out that someone has written an academic examination of Near Dark tickles me to no end.
That's how I felt writing it.
Well, this book just came out in October. It's available from Bloomsbury. It's part of their BFI Film Studies series, and I'm going to say it's a very, very deep dive, the sort of thing that I myself would find myself guilty of doing. It's like, oh, look, new rabbit hole. Let's go there. Oh, look, another rabbit hole. Let's go there.
Yeah.
But it's not a very long book. It's like 100 pages tops.
Something like that. Yeah.
But it is full of such delightful, delightful topics. My favorite one being the sympathetic, not so reluctant vampire. No, you've never met another girl like me.
Yeah, exactly.
that's a great title for a chapter.
I have to say I did have a lot of fun with taking really great lines from the film and using them as chapter titles.
Well, you actually teach classes in film and television studies. Is vampires your bailiwick, or did you just happen along this line of inquiry because of the fun of the topics?
Now, I actually have been writing about vampires for a long time, particularly in film and TV. And I teach a class on vampire films at Roehampton. Although I've recently expanded it to include zombies because, you know, I'm all about diversity. You know, I've expanded my terrain to include all types of undead. So I've been teaching it for years, and Near Dark's often has been a central film that I've been teaching for a long time. I've written about it in other things here and there, but this was my opportunity to really just explore how much I love this film and how much I think it's really worth everyone seeing and thinking about.
Well, how did you come across Near Dark and start trying to strong arm all your friends into seeing it as well?
Well, I first came across it because when I was back in the day, I used to work in a video rental store. So when it first came out on video, I had seen it. Like, I had not seen the film, but I knew it was there. Hadn't watched it. Had a really, really terrible cover on the old video box cover. And I just went, oh, that doesn't look very good. But then I worked for a summer in an audiovisual department of my university in Montreal, Concordia University. Little shout out to Concordia. Mm-hmm. And my boss there said, I was reading like Anne Rice and various other vampire stuff. And she said, well, if you like vampires, you should see this. And she showed me a scene from it, which she had the laser disc. And she showed me a scene from it, which was the barroom massacre, mm-hmm. which if anyone's seen the film knows, this is a really central scene And I looked at it and went, what is this movie? I have to see this movie. This is amazing. And then went out and watched it, and then have been spent, yeah, you're right, years strong arming friends to watch it. Getting writing, you know, keep coming back to my MA dissertation I wrote. I did not only write about it, but it was included. It was included in my PhD thesis. You know, I just keep coming back to this film. It really stuck with me. And now I teach it to all my students who had never heard of it, and they always come out loving it.
Yeah, I've been trying to remember exactly when I saw it, where I saw it, but all I remember is a really rundown theater, a whole bunch of college students, at like a very, very late night. And that's all I can remember. But I remember seeing it, I guess, maybe on cable a few years later. And when I realized that the soundtrack was by Tangerine Dream, I said, oh, I must go get this. And I did. It was a pretty easy thing to snag back then. And the interesting thing, the thing that captured my attention about the film was how you never heard the word vampire.
Yeah.
But you knew what they were. They behaved like it. And they just, they weren't your, you know, the vampires that everybody had come up knowing. And it seemed to be the first in a long, now long pattern of vampires who aren't Dracula or Dracula adjacent.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that was the thing, was that when they made the film, they were very deliberately saying, we're going to make a vampire film, but we're just going to pull out everything that we associate with vampires. So no one's going to use the word. There's not going to be a crucifix in sight. There's not going to be garlic or any of the things, none of the Gothic castles. We're going to remove all of that. And we're going to set it in the Midwest, and we're going to send it in sort of deserty, sun-soaked landscapes, which is not the best place for a vampire. And we're going to make it as like a kind of a hybrid Western. And that's why it really can, when you watch it, and I envy your first seeing it in a cinema and that kind of audience, because it really stands out as this kind of, you know, kind of alien type of rethinking. Now, since it, there have been other films that have done the vampire Western, you know, like I'm not saying it's common, but, you know, From Dusk Till Dawn and stuff like that, you know, we've seen those kinds of films since then, but then no one had done that. And it really did sort of say, we're just going to divest ourselves of Dracula and everything we associate with that, and do something different. And really, and it stands out because of that.
Yeah, everything that I remember back when I would see it, you know, catch it here, catch it there.
Yeah.
Just the aesthetic of it, the cinematography, the composition of a lot of the scenes, especially Lance Henriksen steals every scene he's in.
He does. Just,
it's like you can't help it. He pulls focus to him, and he just drips malice and menace and just everything. It's like, this is my world, and I'm gonna let you know about it.
Absolutely. I mean, and for me, I think what struck me when I first saw it is the fact that you're right, he does drip menace. There is something sort of overwhelmingly frightening about him, and yet there's something also incredibly charismatic. Like, you know, you are drawn to him, like, and the vampires that surround him. And I always felt torn between thinking I kind of like them, but I also am terrified by them. And it really, you know, it really kind of unsettles you. So, you know, in the sense, I always felt like I'm kind of rooting for them, and no, I shouldn't be.
Right.
You know. Because they are really nasty. And he is, I think it's one of, I mean, I'm a huge Lance Henriksen fan. I think he has some stunning performances in his career. But it is definitely one that, for me, that really stood out. Because he is so menacing. While being, he lost, I can't remember how much weight for the role, and he really is very lean. So he's this very tall, lean figure that just screams menace with the big scar on his face, and he has these long, gnarled fingernails. he's frightening. And
creepy.
Yet, some point, he really is. But at the same time, also something quite just. Seductive is not the right word. It is alluring. There's something that you just, like you said, you can't not focus on him when he's on screen, which is a really great element of the vampire. Like, it's a really good reimagining of the vampire.
Yeah, the thing that struck me was how it seemed everything he did was to protect this family that he's built.
Mm. Yeah.
And having a central paternal figure...
Yeah,
of that nature is going to cause some problems, and those problems, as they manifest in the film, are a lot of fun. So, for you, what was the one thing, the first thing, that said, "I have to find out more about this film. I need to write about this film. This is where I'm going with this."
Well, I suppose the first thing was you mentioned the visual style. And this, for me, that this film has such an arresting look. The cinematography, the lighting is phenomenal. And this, because it's called Near Dark, and because it has this, it exists on this kind of twilight landscape of somewhere between sunset and sunrise. And you're always on the cusp of the sun coming up or going down. And I found that visual style really... it really drew me. So I think it was one of the things I just thought, no, this is a really beautifully expressionist film. And I want to kind of keep talking about the style. So that was the first thing. And other people had written about the film a little bit. It's directed by Catherine Bigelow. So she's received various bits of attention throughout her career. So people had touched on it, but no one had really talked about just what a stunning looking film this is and how important that style is to what it's doing with the vampire. But I suppose the second thing that really drew me was the character of May, my not so reluctant vampire, mm-hmm. Who is in a way, as I say in the book, is the one who is the starting point of this story. She's the vampire who turns the hero and makes him this half vampire. So it all hovers around her. And I just found her so ambiguous because she is presented as this kind of waif-like figure, slightly tomboyish. She is slightly androgynous, but she's seductive. So she's playing with convention. She doesn't look like your typical female vampire, particularly in the 1980s when, they looked like Catherine Deneuve and Jamie Gertz and the Lost Boys and stuff like that. And May has this little short boyish hair. She's wearing jeans, cut off t-shirts. She just doesn't look like a vampire as we've seen them. But she also, I think the thing I love about her is that she talks about wanting to be here. She talks about immortality. And says, I'm going to be here in a billion years when the light from that star reaches the earth. And I just thought, who is this woman? Like, she's not in it just for the mayhem. She's not in it just for the blood. She has aspirations. Like, she's all about the experience of the night. And I was fascinated by her and thought, no, I want to write about her. I want to kind of, I keep coming back to her because I just think she is, and nobody was talking about her. I kept thinking, why are people not talking about this character? She is amazing. So those are the two big things. But then the more you watch the film, the more you unpack, the more you're going, but then there's Bill Paxton and he's so much fun. Mm-hmm. There's so much to this film.
Yeah, Bill Paxton's character, it's Severn?
Severn, yes.
He revels in the mayhem.
Yeah.
And the unleashed nature of that attitude was what caught my attention more so than everyone else, because he literally wants to be the center of the trouble.
Yeah, absolutely.
Either causing it or being the reason that it gets caused. He loves that.
And absolutely.
The nature of how they hunted caught my attention early on. I think it was probably like the second or third time I watched it. And I'm like, look how they hunt. They use their appearances, their cleaned up appearances, as lure. You have the kid. He's the victim. He's an accident. He's fallen off his bike. He could be hurt, and that draws in someone who has a parental or maternal protective instinct. Yeah. Oh my God, this kid is hurt. Let me find out. Whoops. Yeah. And the way Lance and Jeanette are the victims of men of ill repute and ill intent. And it's one of those things where you're so going to regret getting up this morning. You see it coming from the very second it rolls down the window. I'm like, oh, this is not going to end well for you. I can't wait to see what happens. The fact that they hunt separately, even though they're a family, they split off and hunt separately. I thought that was really wild, especially in later movies, like Lost Boys is one, where they hunt as a pack.
Yeah.
And just having everybody, you know, split off. Yeah. I think I read a book like that had a scene like that where the vampires live together in this little clique, but they hunt separately. They hunt on their own, either in singles or pairs, mostly in singles. They just go off and do their own thing and come back. I was like, that is a fascinating twist on the vampire family dynamic. And I think you wrote about that a little bit. And there's just so much in this movie that turns the vampire trope on its head. And yet so many films after it took up that role. I was kind of surprised. You see the little kid in Lost Boys. Then you see Kirsten Dunst in Interview with the Vampire. I'm like, what is this with this underage vampire that's supposed to be a taboo to create? And it's played very, very well. Was it the kid Homer, I think it's?
Homer, it's Homer.
In Near Dark. There's a desperation and a pitying side to him that you cannot help but you feel for him. And then he turns into this little killer. And you're like, no, I don't feel sorry. Well, maybe I do. There's a dichotomy there. But it's so much fun.
It is. Well, I think there is something about the idea of the vampiric child. Like you said, you know, there's hints of it. You know, you get that bit in Dracula that, you know, Lucy attacks children. She doesn't turn anyone, but there's that threat. But people have always shied away from it, this idea, because it's unsettling, little demonic child. There's a bit of it. Obviously, Stephen King does it in Salem's Lot, and you get the Glick boys who are terrifying. But there is something about the idea of innocence corrupted. But what I like about Homer is that it's not just that. It's the sense of then once he's corrupted, once he's become this, he's neither one thing nor another. Because as he constantly says, he's an old man in a child's body. Because he's supposed to be, I think, 50 years old or something like that. That's unsettling. There's something like, what is he? He doesn't know what he is. And I think there's something really, Near Dark really taps into that, because he is, sometimes he does behave like a child. And then sometimes you do see the old man in him or the older man or the frustrated man in him. And he's really sad.
Yeah, there's just so much in this movie that you can analyze. And fortunately, it's a fun movie that you can watch and then go back to the beginning and watch it again right then to take more notes.
Yeah.
And some of the things that you describe researching, analyzing to put this together.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you find some of the, because you mentioned at one point you're looking at storyboards. I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah. No, I was really lucky that the full script and storyboards was deposited at the Margaret Herrick Library in Los Angeles. And so they have there are extracts from them. If you have the Blu-ray or DVD of Near Dark, there are extracts from the storyboards on there, which they've included. But the full thing is kept in the library, and I was fortunate enough to be able to go there and spend a couple of days in the library just poring over these. Because of course you can't take them away, you can't take photocopies. So I spent days just poring over them. I have notebooks filled with my sketches where I kind of was trying to capture how the storyboards were designed. So I did my own little sketches to try to mimic them, just to kind of so I would be able to remember it. But it was a great opportunity, because it really is, it does show you a lot of the process and the thinking behind the film, because even, you know, it changed from the script to the storyboard to the film. So you start getting a sense of what they were thinking, how it was evolving, which was really interesting. So that was great. That was really good. Because as we said, the film has such a distinctive visual style. The storyboards were really impressive, like really interesting, because they were very detailed. They had really thought through every camera angle and the lighting, particularly the light. I mean, the lighting is so important to this film. So the way in which they describe the lighting from script to storyboard was really interesting to think that none of this happens by accident. Anyone who has been anywhere near a film set knows that nothing, like, you know, lighting does not happen by accident, but to see the degree to which they were thinking that through and trying to capture a type of visual landscape that was really different to what had been done before. It was really interesting. Yeah.
So
which I was.
You're having fun with it, but what other things did you unearth that helped your research? Because there are a lot of articles that you mentioned that talk about Bigelow's career after. But the early films she did don't get as much notice, at least, you know, not right after Near Dark came out.
No, I mean, I was fortunate that Near Dark got a bit of attention because it was screened at the Museum of Modern Art in New York not long after it came out. I mean, it bombed at the box office. I mean, it played in like 200 cinemas or something like that. Like, it really suffered for distribution. So no one, very few people saw it in the cinema when it came out. But 6 months later, it did get a screening at the Museum of Modern Art because of her connections to the, presumably to the art culture of New York, and they recognized it. So that was really helpful to get a sense. They had some documents, and there are some interesting documents there that they had about the film from its early on. It did receive excellent reviews, or at least a lot, I mean, mixed, but a lot of really good reviews. So it had attention, but then it just vanished because no one went to see it. And of course it came out the same year as The Lost Boys. And, you know, everyone went to see The Lost Boys. Like, Lost Boys was huge. So I think for a long time, it kind of languished because of the popularity of The Lost Boys of that kind of 1980s. So, but if you go back and then start finding interviews with the crew and the film, you know, people working with Kathryn Bigelow, they do start talking about it because its cult following started to build. People started finding this film. They found it on video when it came out on video. So I was, you know, obviously other people were not put off by the not very good video cover that put me off, because it did start finding the audience. So what happened was that people started then asking Bigelow about it, because it would come up. And I saw an interview with her. She said that actually it's probably the one that she gets asked about most often by audiences, because, you know, you'll get people who suddenly go, you know, what about Near Dark? So I think then you start getting she starts talking about it, and you get other people start being interviewed about it, as Adam Greenberg, who was the cinematographer on it. So that was really helpful to start unpacking those elements of it and start getting that history of its reception and cult following, which has been really interesting.
Yeah, I didn't even know that Anchor Bay had put out a Blu-ray of it with all of those bonus features until after you couldn't get it anymore. And I was like, wait, how did this happen? What the? No.
It's definitely ripe for a re-release, like to get something new of it. It'd be great.
Yeah, like somebody needs to start a letter writing campaign to Anchor Bay or to Shout or to Shout Factory, because Shout Factory has their Scream Factory line of horror titles has done some delightful releases the past few years. But I think making the movie harder to find had an influence on people wanting to see it. And you find this fandom, these people who remember this movie fondly, who talk about it so deeply, and you realize it's like, this was a thing. How did it get so badly ignored when it first came out? And then I'm like reading through one of your chapters where you're talking about some of the reviews that it got, and I'm horrified. I'm like, if you feel that badly about violent vampire movies, why did your paper send you?
I know. No, absolutely. You do sort of think, really? You know, for sure. Some of them are great, but some of them really just, it's like they were just horrified by this nasty, grimy movie that just made them feel horrible, which I think is its strength. Like, I think a film, you know, I think that one of the reasons why that a lot of those critics didn't like it is because it made them uncomfortable, which I think the film is supposed to. I think the film absolutely makes you uncomfortable. Of course, and it should, because it is uncomfortable. Like I said, The Barroom Massacre, which was my first entry into this film, is brutal. It is brutal. It's also really funny. And to have a film that walks that line between absolute horror show and humor is designed to make you feel uncomfortable. You know, and if you don't feel uncomfortable, then that's not really good. But some critics don't want to be made to feel uncomfortable. You know, that's crossing a line, particularly the more conservative papers. Just, you could just tell they were just kind of, and yet others were just like, this is amazing. This is like George Romero meets Terrence Malick. Like, you know, people were, some people really just tapped into what this film was doing in a really kind of exciting way. But unfortunately, like I said, the distribution just meant that no one saw it. Like, it played in so few cinemas, you know, until it came out on video. And then it just found that audience. And like you said, a film that is, people started searching it out. It's when it gets harder to find, it developed a cult following, and then people look for it. I think that's why the film has had a kind of very exciting afterlife, is because people had to work to see it. Once people do, they often are really positive and really excited by and very passionate about it.
Yeah, because, I mean, like you said before, there's a lot to enjoy about this movie. There's a lot to unpack about this movie.
Yep.
It entertains you. It makes you think. It makes you rethink how certain, you know, supernatural incidents of violence can be portrayed. That dive bar massacre is brutal. It is, if you haven't been accustomed to that, It probably doesn't seem as brutal today as it did 30 years ago.
No.
But if you imagine seeing it, you know, somewhere, you know, before 1992 or 93, you're going to go, oh, wow.
Yeah. And that's it. Because I think the thing is, it's not very, in retrospect, you look at it, it's not very graphic. I mean, you know, there's barely any blood for a vampire film. You know, that's, you know, there, you don't see much. But I think it's just the fact that it is, you know, there's something about the pleasure they're taking in the mayhem and the nastiness. So that's what, and I think that still really holds up. Like, I think that's like you watch it and you go, no, they are taking a lot of pleasure in cruelty. So, right. It does. It's by 21st century standards. This isn't a Michael Haneke film. You know, there are loads of films out there where people are brutal and it's a very different level of torture. That's not what this is. But there is a pleasure they take in mayhem that is uncomfortable. And I think that still holds up really well. And I think the film does, it still feels very resonant. Like, you know, you don't feel like you have to forgive too much for, you know, it's because it's 1980s.
And I think that might be a key point in what you were talking about, making some viewers uncomfortable, is they seem to revel in the destruction. We've seen so many movies of sadistic serial killers, and there's malice, there's evil, there's just angry intent, and you cannot empathize with that. You can understand it, but you cannot empathize with that.
Yeah.
But in Near Dark, in that scene, they seem like they're having fun at an out of control frat party. They are enjoying what they're doing, despite the fact that what they are doing is killing everyone.
Absolutely. And the other thing about that scene, which for me, that I think is what makes it uncomfortable for some people, is the fact that part of the point of that scene is you have this half vampire Caleb who's resisting his nature. So he's refusing, he's unable to kill. And they're trying to get him to do it. They're trying to push him to do it. And the way the sequence is shot is that as an audience, you find yourself urging him to do it. Like, just get on with it, just do it. Because that's how it's structured, because it's all from their perspective. And from their perspective, he is a threat. He is a threat to their lifestyle if he can't learn how to kill.
Right.
So, and that's a really uncomfortable thing to suddenly realize that actually I always feel this while watching it. I am rooting. I'm like, oh, just get on with it, Caleb. Just do, you know? And then I go, what am I saying? What am I saying? I find that really interesting. The other thing I find interesting about people's responses, and particularly a lot of the reviewers, I think a lot of people were uncomfortable by the fact that it was a woman director. And it comes up in a lot of the reviews that they are kind of looking at, like, what is she, you know, that something odd and weird about her making this film. And people get very focused on her appearance and that she's so, you know, I was actually quite shocked by the degree to which every time how many reviews talked about her being this kind of tall, willowy, beautiful woman making this film. And just somehow, so there's really interesting attitudes about gender going on, I think, in some of the responses to this film. And it's people being uncomfortable at it, which I think if it had been made by a man, they might be a little less. They may not have liked the film, but they might have been a little less kind of disturbed by it, at least with some of the reviews.
That's interesting. It makes sense in hindsight.
Yeah.
That it's like, oh my God, here's a woman not making Jane Eyre or Emily Bronte stories about tea parties. Oh dear, what can we do? Like, clutch your pearls in another world, get out of here.
exactly. And I think that's the thing that today, I mean, there are so many women making really exciting horror films today that, you know, that's very easy to lose track of that. But in 1980s, there weren't that many. There were other women, for sure, but there weren't that many. And so, it was sort of an odd one. And you know, you read the first half of her career, every review talks of, you know, not just this film, but most of the films she made, people talk about how strange it is to have a woman making action films and, you know, these kind of typical quote unquote masculine genres. Right. And it takes a while, then people eventually stop saying that, or at least I hope they have. You never know.
It's like, they may have stopped saying it out loud as much, but you see this this attitude is like, why can't a woman make an action movie? Why can't a woman make a horror movie? Some of the better movies that have come out in the past year were horror films by women.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
There was an anthology movie a couple of years ago called Double X. It was when was that? 3 years ago, maybe? Four?
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
And it was brilliant. It was beautiful. Yeah. You know, there was an unevenness to some of the different stories, but they were all really well done.
They were really good.
It's not like women can't tell these stories. It's the pigeonholing and the funneling into, here's what we think you should be. It's like, why not let me tell the story I was put here to tell? The world will be a better place, and I won't feel the need to stick a fork in your throat.
Exactly. Yeah. No, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I think those attitudes are still out there to a degree, but it's just changing all the time because, you know, it's just, you're right. Some of the best horror films that come out in recent years have been by women, really exciting films. So it's changing. And I think she was part of that. I think this film is, particularly in the 80s, there are a few, but not that many. And it's a really, I think, an important precursor to a lot of the films you see coming out now.
Mm-hmm. Well, for those who enjoy academic takes on television and film studies, this is a fun one. You can tell you really, really, truly enjoyed your subject matter.
Yeah, and thank you.
The fact that you also, like, you teach not your vampires, but horror in general, zombies also, but it's time to talk about Angel, because that's one of my favorite TV shows. I was a fan of Buffy, like everybody was back then. Mm-hmm. And then Angel came along, and I'm like, I like Angel better than Buffy. And I got into a number of arguments with friends about that. And it's just, it seemed like Angel, no pun intended, was allowed to spread his wings in a scenario without Buffy, where Buffy stayed, you know, in this very narrow track until, spoiler alert, after she died. And I just, there's something about the nature of the show Angel being darker, exploring literally the seedy underbelly of Los Angeles and exposing it as having an undercurrent of the city's denizens as predators, and him standing up against the predators. And then you have the whole turning everything on its head.
Yeah.
Okay, you won. Here.
Yeah.
And they're like, what do you mean we won? It's like, yeah, you ended world peace, so we're going to gift you. You're going to just take the Los Angeles. And they're like, wait, we beat the demon and we ended world peace? That wasn't the plan. The way that whole thing was just turned on its head. I'm like, oh, okay. The good guys win by bringing back evil. Huh. But I just enjoy all of Angel.
Yeah.
Just, there's so many different layers. Yeah. Some problematic stuff I've learned about later, but the story for me is still enjoyable to watch. What is it about the vampire we know as Angel that attracted your attention?
Well, like you, I started watching Buffy, and I loved Buffy, and Angel on Buffy was fine. Like, I liked the character, but he was very limited. Like, he was the love interest. Mm-hmm. And what, so like you, I went to the series because I, you know, at this point I was doing my PhD, so I was writing about vampire films, so I had to follow the vampire. You know, he's got his own show. I'm going to watch this. And what I liked was the fact that suddenly you took a character who was quite intentionally two-dimensional on Buffy, because we only see him from her point of view. You know, it's her story, and it's, you know, he's limited. And to see him become this really rich character. Morally complex. He's someone who is dealing with the weight of centuries worth of killing and mayhem and feels the responsibility for that and looking for some sense of redemption. And then he becomes this spokesperson for people who, the people who are the unseen, the people who are not protected by the traditional spaces of protection. You know, they're not protected by people who, you know, by in the day, as he says, you know, it's like there's people to take care of people during the day. He's there to protect the people at night who need help. And so I really love that. And I love the fact that he could be, yet you never deny the fact that he had been a monster. He was a monster. You know, he still had a bloodlust. He just controlled it. You know, he didn't want to give in to it. So I always loved that about him, that he was so much struggling. I like the fact that he could be a bit of a goof, that suddenly he was kind of out of his depth in the human world. And that he wasn't just perfect all the time as the way Buffy saw him, you know, this great kind of gothic hero. No, he was a bit of an idiot at times. And he was often wrong. So I love that aspect of it. And like you said, the Los Angeles landscape became, you know, this idea of the underbelly of a city. It's not new. This whole series was completely tapped into a long history of film noir, which I've always been a fan of. So I love that kind of noir landscape. So to me, him becoming this vampire detective was wonderful. Like I just said, no, that's great. You're in Los Angeles, that you're just tapping into this whole history of the kind of darkness of urban life and the corruption. And then to have the big villain of the series be a big corporation like Wolfman Hart. So we're not going to have the big bad that we see on Buffy, who's going to be the mayor, it's going to be the master. You know, we have these individuals. No, we're going to have a corporation, you know, big business, multi-dimensional corporation. I thought, well, that's brilliant. That is just great because A, it speaks so much to the world we're in. You know, really, in fact, I still find Angel more relevant now. Like, I just feel like Angel still speaks to the world we're in because you're fighting against a system and you're not just fighting against individuals. Yeah. So I loved all of that. And that sense of the complexity of how do you fight something like that? How do you fight something that is not a person? It's not a monster. It's not just an individual or even a group of individuals. Like, it's, you know, it's something that goes beyond that. And I like the fact that it constantly confronts it and it doesn't resolve it. It doesn't say there's an easy answer. We're not going to solve it. And it, you know, and again, no spoilers, but the way the show ended is just about saying the whole point is you have to keep fighting.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like there's an easy answer. The point is to fight.
Yeah. The institutional nature.
Yeah,
institutionalized evil.
Absolutely.
And the fact that it was a law firm.
Yeah.
You have the criminal law lawyers on one side. You have your corporate lawyers on another side. Yeah. You have your tax lawyers on a different side. But they're all lawyers in service of protecting, insulating, and furthering evil.
Exactly.
And maintaining the relationships, the resources, the investments, the money, the everything that allows this institution to keep going. And there's no way to stop it because even if you lose an entire division of lawyers to, shall we say, an angry upper management, an angry partner.
Yeah, exactly.
There are still more lawyers that can come in. And I think it was, I hadn't fully bought into it until I saw the movie The Firm, where the entire law firm's main practice was insulating this mob organization. I'm like, oh, okay. So yeah, I guess maybe it can.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that final season when they're running the firm, when they're kind of given the reins to say, here, you, as you said, you've won. here, you can take over the firm and do whatever you want to with it, which, you know, makes them, yeah. So you fall into that whole narrative mm-hmm. of, we'll fight the belly, the monster from the belly of the beast. You know, we'll do it from the inside. But then they're told the key thing is the bottom line. What you have to do is make sure they're making money. As long as you're making money, you can do whatever you want with this institution, but you have to do it. So as soon as you have to make money, then you're making choices. So you're saying, well, I want to save these people, but that's not profitable. So and I thought that was really well done. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought actually the sense of, you could go into this naively thinking that we'll be able to use these resources. But as soon as you buy into those resources, you are part of the problem. And yes. You can't, you know, and I thought that was really that sense of them having to confront that and realize their own naivety, that they think that they can fix this from inside. And you go, no, because you're part of the problem.
Yeah.
you know, and to have the confidence to do that for the show, I thought was really good. It was very mature. And so, like you, I've always just, for me, again, love Buffy. Don't want all the Buffy fans out there to think, but I love Buffy, but I just respond to Angel. I think it's a really rich show that it gets stronger the more I watch it, and seems more relevant. Like, I just keeps feeling, it doesn't feel 20 years old, because yeah. I go, no, actually, this still feels true, more true now than ever. You know?
Yeah, a lot of everything that's in there still resonates. You know, Angel's struggle with his dark side in the earlier seasons. A lot of people didn't like some aspects of when they took over Wolf from Hart, but I thought that there were so many layers there that even I still haven't dove into it, because you take them, you put them in a corporate setting, you say, here, all these resources are yours to do with what you would, you know, we don't care if you attack us, as long as you're still profitable, we'll leave you alone. Yeah. And they, in effect, what their strength was working together. And by making each of them heads of different departments, they didn't get to interact. They didn't get to work together. They didn't get to coordinate their efforts to check each other.
Yeah.
You know, say, hey, are you really think this is a good idea? And it's like, hey, should you really be setting people free to maintain your intellect magic? Should you really open that sarcophagus? I mean, really?
Yeah, exactly. No, don't do it. Yeah, no, absolutely.
And just that's just to me, it was just so well done. And it's not until everything they care about is about to be destroyed that they come back together and work together as a team, and they're effective again. And I'm like, neutralize their strengths by separating them and
absolutely.
Watch them flail and try to do more and more and more and more to maintain the bottom line so they can, quote, keep fighting against a bad guy from inside. It's like, no, you are the bad guy now.
Yeah, exactly. And it takes a lot of confidence for a TV series to do something which you know is going to make your audience uncomfortable. So you're right, splitting up that group, putting them there, suddenly taking away a lot of the things that people liked about the show, which is the dynamic of the group together. It's that, you know, cohesion, the team Angel. You know, it makes people uncomfortable, and it's frustrating, and it is a frustrating thing. And I think it takes a lot of confidence to say, no, there's a point to this. And, you know, and it makes that end all the more satisfying when they finally do work together. And you think, no, I think I really respect that, because, you know, you can just always give people what they want or say, look, yeah, we could just keep doing it the way we did it and keep having them in the Hyperion Hotel and they'll all be working together. And but no, saying, no, we've done that, now we want to tell this story of what it means, we're going to take this to the next level in terms of this war with Wolfram and Hart, with the corporation. So I thought it was a very brave move, and it works, and it does. And I think most people I know who struggled with it on initial viewing, when they rewatch it, once you know where it's going, like, you really kind of go, no, I get this. Like, I really, and it's more pleasurable the more you watch it, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. Now, the book you wrote on Angel was what, about 10 years ago?
Oh, yeah, God, yes, it was about 10 years ago. Feels like yesterday.
Now, is that still available?
It is, yes, she says, shamelessly plugging. It's available through Wayne State University Press. And it's interesting because it's part of a similar series to the Near Dark book, which is Near Dark is a BFI Classics. The Angel book is part of a TV Milestones series. So they do individual books on individual TV shows. So as far as I know, it's still available.
Well, I will actually go look that up because I have, like I said, I'm a fan of Angel. Shameless plug here. I just recently wrote two essays in the X-Files universe. The first book of that has come out from ATB Publishing. And after the book, or right before the book came out, I went to their website to check it out. And they had a book there, a collection of like 130 essays on Angel and Firefly. Like one writer wrote one essay for each episode of both shows. And like for X-Files, that was mine. I wrote an essay on Kolchak, the rebooted Kolchak.
Oh, wow, excellent. I love that.
And I'm like, wait, there are 100 and some essays on Angel that I have not read. Let me get this book.
Exactly.
So I'm making my way through that book, and the just how many people still like this show, how many people still want to talk about the most minute details about that show still just floors me and gives me happiness.
Me too. Because I spent a long time sort of having probably similar conversations to you with people saying, you know, but there's Angel. Like people, yes, we love Buffy, but Angel. And it was a running joke with so many people I know. I go, I would always end conversation with, but on Angel, we do this. Like, you know, let's not forget. And it is really nice because I think the interest has built in it because I think it, because it is still resonant. And I think a lot of people initially, I mean, I was always surprised by people who were fans of Buffy who didn't go to Angel because it seemed like a natural thing to do.
Really?
I watched Buffy. I'm going to go. Like, it seemed, but some people didn't. I think it's because they either didn't like the character on the show or just didn't see the potential of what he had to offer. And I think, so I keep saying to people, no, you can't judge the TV series by the character from Buffy because the whole point of it is he becomes something quite so much more because it's his show, you know, which means you can kind of challenge some of the ways the Buffy saw him. I think they really do self-consciously say, no, he's not going to be that character. And we're going to see how he doesn't see himself that way. And he sees himself in very complex ways. And yeah, I just thought it was brilliant. But also, you know, for people who like Buffy, you know, it brings two of the best characters. Well, definitely one of the best characters from Buffy, which is Cordelia, who was a great character on Buffy, but who could only ever go so far on Buffy. And then she was great on Angel because she had, again, so much more space to go. And then you have Wesley, who was a character on Buffy who was in, what, half a season and was a kind of foil, comic foil. And then he becomes, for me, probably one of the most rich characters of the whole universe because his arc is so complicated. And I think, again, so I think there's a lot to enjoy about Angel, not just the Angel character. Those other characters, you know, you mentioned the sarcophagus, the Illyria, the Fred Illyria character is amazing. Like, and what a stunning thing to do, as painful as some of it was also a great creation of a character. Gunn, like, they're all really good characters and they all have their really complicated arcs, which I like.
Yeah, I always saw Wesley's arc as sort of being a mirror, a reverse of what we knew of Giles, because Giles went down a dark path and then sort of recovered himself by becoming a watcher, by becoming this font of knowledge and this fighter for light. Whereas we see Wesley, he gets lost for a while. Even when he's with his friends, he gets lost for a while and he goes down a really, really dark path.
Yeah.
And then his attempt to redeem himself to when he tries to set the timeline right again because he thinks he'll get Fred back, that just causes so much destruction in the end, including, spoiler alert, his own.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I think his character is really kind of wonderfully rich and complicated because of that, and that he aspires to the best. Like, he aspires to the best values. I was rewatching recently his episodes on Buffy, and even then, one of the things that strikes me about Wesley is that he's always prepared to speak the truth and speak the hard truths. And even on Buffy, you know, he's the one who's saying when Willow gets abducted that we shouldn't, you know, there's the whole narrative with the mayor, and no, they shouldn't try to save her because more people will die. And of course, on Buffy, the right choice is to save Willow. It is the right choice. In a big grand universe, one person versus the universe is not the right choice. And Wesley is from the start the person who's prepared to say, no, we shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't make the personal choice. And it's when he does do those personal things that he goes awry and he really gets lost, because suddenly he is trapped in himself, in his own trauma. And I really like that complexity of him trying to negotiate what is genuinely right versus what is personally right, or, you know, what feels right versus what is right. He's very rich.
Yeah. I always looked at the way he handled capturing Faith.
Yeah.
As he realized he made wrong mistakes previously, following his instincts, following his gut. So in this one instance, he's going to ignore his feelings. He's going to ignore his gut. He's going to follow protocol, do what's right, and makes the entire situation worse.
Absolutely.
And he kind of realizes it, but I don't think he accepts it until later in Angel, when Faith comes across him again and lets him know how absolutely unhappy she is with his betrayal. And I'm like, wow, the fact that they brought that back around and gave it sort of a closure was really, for me, from a storytelling point of view, I'm like, oh, nicely done. Golf clap.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I agree. I think that Faith narrative with him is really well done. And to have him not just realize the mistakes he made, but the damage caused by that, mistake, the ripples of that mistake and how it's impacted. You know, I think that is a really formative moment for him. Mm-hmm. And he continues to have those. He has those moments where, and that's why I just always really like them. And then, you know, I always think one of the things that strikes me by him at the end is that being the failed watcher on Buffy, it's like by the end with Illyria, it's like he's finally become the watcher, that he is taking care of her, he is helping her, he is guiding her. And I always really like that for him, that it takes him that whole journey to finally get to a moment where he is that person that he wanted to be, even if it's been a painful journey to get there. And as you say, it kind of doesn't fare well for his final
moment. But the thing that struck me, I think it was mostly the third time I saw the series through, was how his not taking action against Faith after she had tortured him and letting Angel handle her from the way out, that echoes, because if Faith had died, if he had killed Faith, there's no way they would have gotten Angel back from Angelus.
Yeah, exactly.
And that all comes together. I'm like, I love this. It's frustratingly annoying that all these bad things are happening, but they tie together so well.
They do. And then to create that whole narrative of redemption, that they're all, like, every character on Angel at some point or other is seeking redemption for things they've done. And so even though it's Angel's show and he's the kind of primary figure who's leading that narrative of redemption, it becomes a redemption for all of them. They all have something to redeem. They're all struggling against aspects of themselves. They feel they need to be redeemed. And I really like that, that it's not just down to the vampire with the soul. You know, it's actually people. We all have things. We've all done things that we recognize the repercussions of decisions we make. It may not mean be as life changing as some of the things on Angel, we hope, but we all live in a world of ripples based on our choices. And I like the fact that this show is about that. And, you know, they always said, you know, Buffy was about growing up and Angel was about being an adult.
Yeah.
And actually in about those adult, what it means to be an adult and confront that. And I like that a lot. Yeah.
Now you are in England.
Yes.
Were you ever able, well, actually, no, those took place before you got there, probably. The four, I think there was four different academic conferences on Buffy that were held in England.
I was at the first Buffy conference at UEA in Norwich. Yeah, I can't remember what year it was now. It was so long ago, but I was, giving a paper on Angel.
Oh, wow.
That was the beginning of my, you know, but then there's Angel, because at that point, there were not many papers on Angel at that conference, but I did, because I like to be difficult. It was amazing. Yeah, I definitely went to that, and it was an amazing conference. I remember just thinking, no, this is exciting to be in a world where we're all standing in a room talking about Buffy and Angel. And yeah.
Yeah, that was my question. How many papers related to Angel were there over the course of those different conferences that you know of?
It's gotten more. I mean, then I can't remember. It really wasn't many. I was talking about Angel. There were probably a handful. I mean, it was that first conference I went to was about 3 days and with parallel panels. So I don't remember how many papers there were, but there were a lot. And it was a handful that was on Angel. So it was Buffy, largely Buffy, with a few of us. It's gotten better. And I've been to quite a few other conferences over the years. And I have to say, you know, the first few, there were a minority of people talking about Angel. And I have to say, it's really nice to see that that's changed. Actually, more and more people are talking about Angel. And that was nice to suddenly see that taking that kind of resonance really sinking in a way that was not there initially, where it was sort of, I mean, people were interested, but not, you know, so much attention was still focused on Buffy. So it's nice. It's gradually changing.
Well, who knows? Maybe you'll get to do a second book on Angel.
That would be great. That would be great. There's always more to say.
Oh, good.
There's always more to say.
So where can people find Stacey Abbott online, keep track of what other vampire and zombie stories now that you're following?
I am, well, let's see. I know I should be better at this and use my Twitter. I am on Twitter. What is it? It's at Stacey Abbott RU. So Roehampton University. So at Stacey Abbott RU on Twitter is one place to find me. Otherwise my university webpage is, you can find my details there. And then I'm kind of just here and there, you know, I've just edited an issue of a horror journal for coming out of Montreal called Monstrum, which we did an issue on Supernatural. So, you know, which is all tied into the end of Supernatural. Mm-hmm. So I'm still working on finishing that off because it only just ended. So we're, you know, I'm here and there.
Cool. Well, we will have links to those various places where people can find you. And just so people know, that ATB Publishing volume on Angel and Firefly, I'm going to be giving away a copy of that. So stay tuned after the break for details on that. Stacey, thank you so much for your time, your indulgence in vampire television today.
Thank you. Thank you for indulging me. I'm more than happy to talk about all of this.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Slice of Sci-Fi.
Escape Pod is your destination for the best in modern short science fiction. Our intrepid crew of editors and hosts will bring you fun, thought-provoking in-flight entertainment every week as the pod careens around the multiverse. In the mood for a classic? We've got Anson Mount, also known as Captain Christopher Pike, reading Theodore Sturgeon. Want something a little more up-to-date? Jennifer R. Donahue's surveillance fatigue has you covered in every sense. From classic space opera to intimate character drama, from heroic alien pets waiting for their families to herds of Einsteins and the benevolent conspiracy they're hatching, Escape Pod has it all. Take a ride with us at escapepod.org and buckle up, because it's story time.
Hi guys, this is Tom Allison, and I play Pree on Killjoys, and you're listening to A Slice of Sci-Fi.
Yes, and as you could tell, that conversation could have gone on for a very, very, very long time. There, we easily could have dovetailed from Angel into Moonlight into Forever Night, even into Blood Ties. There are so many vampire detective stories that we could have hopped through, but there, you know, that would have been like a 3-hour show. And I, if she ever does another Angel book, we're gonna have that conversation. But the ATB Publishing, in addition to the volume one of the X-Files collection they have published, which came out mid-October, in which I have an essay about the Kolchak reboot, the Night Stalker reboot that came out in 2005. They, a couple years ago, put out a book, same format, one essay per episode, where they did all of the episodes of Angel plus all of the episodes of Firefly. And I have a copy of that Angel Firefly collection to give away. I have not yet decided how that contest will be formatted. So if you want, you can email me or hit me up on Twitter with suggestions. And one lucky person will get a copy of that book. If you have any questions or comments on vampire detectives, vampire movies, vampire TV shows, essays about vampires, vampire fiction, because the TV show Blood Ties started out as a series of novels by Tanya Huff, which are awesome, and you should go check them out if you can. Leave your own comments about those shows and those movies and those books. The number to call is 602-635-6976. Leave a voicemail message, or if you have something longer to get off your chest, send me an email. That email is summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, on Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Player FM, and iHeartRadio Podcasts. And if you're listening to Slice of Sci-Fi on Apple or on Stitcher, please help signal boost the show. Leave a review, leave a comment. Everything you do to help boost the show is welcomed and appreciated, because more listeners means more eyes on the website, means possibly a few extra pennies in ad revenue, which we can really truly use about here. You can follow us on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi. And yes, I will get into conversations about the show, about all the stuff I watch, about all the stuff, well, some of the stuff I read, genre stuff mostly. And, you know, hey, signal boost your favorite interviews on Twitter. I will like them, retweet them. And is it re-retweet or is it retweet? Because you can retweet something that's been retweeted. I'm not going down that rabbit hole right now. But yeah, we converse on Twitter all the time at Slice of Sci-Fi. And you can also check out some content we have over on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/sliceofscifi. And of course, there's the website, sliceofscifi.com. Come on by, leave a comment on your favorite interviews, on a review that you loved or a review you disagreed with. We're geeks. We argue. That's what we do. I'd like to thank everyone who is helping support the efforts here at Slice of Sci-Fi and of all the other podcasts and websites in the Slice of Sci-Fi universe, including Writers After Dark and Babylon Podcast. Your donations through PayPal, your pledges through Patreon help keep all of this online. And for that, I am thankful and grateful to you all. If you would like to add your support to these geeky efforts here, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofsci-fi. Or if a monthly pledge is not something you can commit to at the moment, but you still want to help, you can use the PayPal link, paypal.me/sci-fi-summer. And if you're really, truly old-fashioned, there is a mailing address at the bottom of the website you can use to send a check. Old school. Really old school. Any way you can support is truly, truly welcomed. And for those of you who are on Patreon, there are perks at the beginning of each month. I pick an email address out of the patron's hat, and that person gets to choose from a DVD, a 4K, a Blu-ray, a finished book, an advanced copy of a book. I have a lot of materials here that I am running out of space for, and the best way I know to pass on the swag is to you, the people who support the show, help keep it going. So keep an eye out for that if you are on Patreon. But that will do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.